Commonwealth.
Afternoon, Mr. McAfee. Mr. Katz. Mr. McAfee, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you may begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. There are 10 assignments of error, and obviously I'll not be able to address
each of those. Do all that in 15 minutes.
No, there's no possibility, Judge. So I will rely upon the arguments made in the brief. And I'll begin with the first assignment of error, which is the sufficiency of evidence, and I recognize that the appeal fight I might have with challenging a guilty verdict on a murder charge on alleging that there was insufficient evidence. But having been around a bit, I prosecuted a long time, and I've been in cases. I've never had a case where the entire scientific evidence in a case corroborated the defendant's theory.
Let me interrupt you, counsel, because when I read your brief, it read a lot like a jury argument. And while I thought it was a very good jury argument, I'm not sitting on a jury. I'm sitting on an appellate court where we review issues of law. And a lot of what you had to say there was simply an argument that the jury should have interpreted the evidence differently than it did. And you point to a lot of discrepancies or issues that were raised to the jury, and the jury obviously had an opportunity to consider all those things. And I presume you did argue everything you suggested on brief, at least, that the jury should have considered. So presumably they did. They nevertheless found your client guilty, and it seems to me that, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but the Commonwealth's case comes down to, it seems to be some inconsistent statements made by your client, the fact that he was present at the scene when his wife died, and that his DNA is found on the hand grip of the weapon, but not on the receiver area where he testified that he had grabbed the weapon. And finally, the location of the wound in the neck, I guess, was, I guess, not a typical place one would typically shoot oneself if they were committing suicide. So if that's the you know, and that, I will grant you that that's a lot to work with for a defense attorney, it seems to me, but nevertheless, the jury was satisfied. So where does that leave us?
Well, I believe that the evidence that I cited wasn't just argument, but it was undisputed facts from the scientific community. I mean, I tried to present it in a way that was persuasive, and maybe that sounded like argument. But I don't think a jury can arbitrarily disregard scientific evidence. And I take issue with some of the things the court has indicated. For example, the wound to the throat is not an atypical location for a suicide wound. I'm not sure where that's in the record. In fact, I think it's to the contrary. But the DNA issue was that there was blood found on the left side of the grip that had three contributors to the blood. The undisputed evidence was that the sheriff's office didn't find any blood on the left side of the grip. They had the weapon the entire time from the date of the death until it was submitted to the laboratory. So either A, they didn't document it, or the most likely result is that the blood that was there came from the wound on his hand. I don't think there's a third possibility there. They found the DNA from the blood, so it's not.
But I think what you're missing is our standard of review is taking the evidence like most favorable to the Commonwealth. Is there evidence that satisfies each element of the offense? Now, this case comes down to either suicide or murder, it seems to me. Your client places himself at the scene. He has admitted handling the weapon in a certain place, but yet that is not where his DNA is found. And he's made inconsistent statements to others about what happened that night. So, you know, the question really for us, it seems to me, is not what we would have done if we'd been sitting in the jury box, because we might very well agree with you. The question is it totally unreasonable, or does it defy any kind of common sense for the fact finder, for this case to have even gone to the fact finder in the first place, because that's what a sufficiency argument is all about.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with the legal standard that you're talking about, but I disagree with the conclusion the court's drawing. And
I suspect you would.
Yes, sir. And I've tried to detail the facts that are present in this case. And one of the things I would just point to, Your Honors, is that the theory the Commonwealth had, I mean, Mr. Carter had to pull the trigger, or he would have had to somehow manipulate her hand to pull the trigger. I mean, that's the only two ways that this could have happened for him to be guilty of murder. And I would disagree, too. It could have been an accidental discharge, as he indicated. He was trying to take it away from her, and, of course, it could have been accidentally discharged. Could have been the suicide, or as the Commonwealth would suggest, this was an intentional killing. But how, if you take the undisputed scientific evidence in this case, presented by the Commonwealth, how did Mr. Carter accomplish the pulling of the trigger? And the answer is, he couldn't. Lieutenant Ellis, during the cross-examination, admitted it was not possible for it to occur the way the Commonwealth had theorized it. Marge Harris, the blood spatter expert, gave detailed testimony how the entire scene indicated this was a self-inflicted wound and that Mr. Carter's hands or any third party would not have been able to put their hand over the trigger guard or over the trigger and pull the trigger and kill her without having a void on her hand where the blood spatter was found from the wound. So I'm going to have zero time for other issues, but I'll be happy to answer. I don't know how to, if I could go on to another issue, or does the court have questions about that issue?
Well, I don't have any questions about that issue. If you want, I'd be curious if you want to address the prosecutor's so-called demonstration.
Yes. The prosecutor wanted to show the jury that his account of how he had his left hand injured in the whipping space, where he claimed that he was reaching over and trying to get his hand between the hammer and where it was applied, preventing basically the hammer from coming down and the weapon discharging. And he had a wound there. Dr. Daniel is the only forensic pathologist testifying, and he's explaining that there are multiple places in this area where that there are sharp edges that would have produced that.
Well, I don't want to use up all your time. Let me cut to the chase.
Yes, sir.
The question for me is, the court basically instructed the jury to disregard all of that. Why isn't that sufficient?
Well, Judge, I don't believe that's what the record says.
Disregard the demonstration.
Well, if you'll read the exact language, Mr. Qual says, well, I'm sorry, I apologize for making a comment. And the court says, it's an interrupted part of the transcript, but the court says, well, I'm going to tell the jury to disregard. And that is the entire comment the court makes. The court never addressed the actual demonstration. And I don't believe, because, I mean, we've alleged that this is a constitutional issue, that when a prosecutor becomes a witness in a case, as he obviously did here, I mean, he's firing the gun on his own hand and then showing it to the jury and to say, look, here's why you can't believe Mr. Carter. Look when I fired, it didn't produce the same type of injury. He's become a witness. And what he showed the jury to show that Mr. Carter should not be believed, to indicate how dastardly this really is, on the brief that Mr. Qualls filed on the petition, he explains that he really wasn't trying to do that. He had a different purpose that no one ever knew about. His explanation to this court in the reply to the petition was the first time we ever knew this. So he has in effect given an impression to the jury of something that really he did not do. He left the impression with the jury that he fired the weapon, it didn't produce the same injury that Mr. Carter had, therefore Mr. Carter couldn't be telling the truth. The defendant didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine him. There's cases that talk about when the prosecutors inject themselves into a case by demonstrating evidence on themselves, that is an improper conduct by the prosecutor. And I submit that it's a constitutional violation. It's a Sixth Amendment issue, and we've asserted that on brief. If I could speak about the Alford, the witness Alford, one of the most damaging bits of evidence in the case was actually not even admitted for its truthfulness. It was an impeachment comment. Mr. Alford testifies for the Commonwealth. He professes that he remembers some things, but a lot of things. He has been many years since these conversations had occurred, and he doesn't have a recollection of ever saying certain things to law enforcement. The court declares him to be hostile and adverse, and then permits impeachment of Mr. Alford, and there's a long discourse and objections that are made to the court. And a cautionary instruction is requested when the court overrules the objections by counsel to allowing this to occur. There's two in my brief amount of time I have left. I would cite the Smallwood case of the court where the fact that a witness doesn't recall making a statement is not sufficient for that witness to be declared hostile or adverse, and that the person calling that party is then allowed to impeach the witness and prove a prior inconsistent statement. It actually has to be injurious, as the phrase is in Smallwood, and that is never addressed in Commonwealth's brief in response. They talk about that this is an abuse of discretion standard. I recognize that, but they never address the fact that the Smallwood case requires that the surprise testimony becomes injurious to Commonwealth.
And I take it your definition of injurious would be something different than just simply not helpful. Not being helpful is not the same as being injurious. Is that
yes,
your position?
Yes, I believe the Smallwood case talks about injurious or harmful. I believe it has in the disjunctive or harmful. So you get, I believe, in the Smallwood case talks about it. A witness says, I don't remember. I don't remember saying those things. And the comment that is allowed to be introduced, the counsel asked for the cautionary instruction and is never given. Now, the Commonwealth says that issue is waived, but we asked for that at the time that the court's making this ruling. We asked for it a couple times thereafter, and it's never given until the end of the case. And I submit to the court that is certainly a problem.
At the time, let's see, if I'm understanding the record correctly, at Appendix 1964, the objection, I'm not even sure it's an objection, it's more of an observation that the inconsistent statement can only be considered as to the witness's credibility, which I think is a correct statement of the law. So is that what you assert to be a contemporaneous objection?
Well, I don't have that particular part of the record right in front of me, but in our brief, we go through in detail the objections that we made and arguments we made why Mr. Alford was not a hostile witness and should not be impeached in the manner that the Commonwealth was going to do that. And
the cautionary instruction was requested. It wasn't immediately given. It was given the next day, as I understand the record.
No, it was not given the next day. It was not given. It was not given until the end of the trial. There's multiple requests for it. It's not given.
Let's assume that's the case.
Yes,
what's
sir.
The harm? Do we assume the jury disregarded the instruction simply because it was given closer in time to deliberations than when the statements were actually made?
Well, I think in many cases a cautionary instruction can come at times during the trial or at the end of the trial, and all that is fine. But when you look at the totality of this record, one of the most damaging comments allegedly that came from Mr. Carter is this impeaching statement that the officer introduced to the jury. And I submit to the court that one of the most difficult tasks we would ever ask a jury to do is try to figure out this legal principle. Now, I'm going to let you listen to this statement, but I'm telling you that the only reason we're letting you listen to this horrible statement is that this is to impeach the credibility of Mr. Alford. Now, I know that the court and counsel are able to discern that legal principle, but I submit that for most lay people on juries, that is a difficult concept to grasp. And if the court doesn't tell them at the time that it's being introduced the limiting nature of it, the entire purpose of that statute that is enacted by the General Assembly is frustrating. It seems to me the General Assembly has, I'm out of time, I think.
Well, I'm going to give you a couple extra minutes on rebuttal, but before you sit down, I'd like for you to address briefly, please, the cigarette issue.
Yes, sir.
With the juror.
Frankly, I and the Commonwealth has not cited any case either. I cannot find any case authority, appellate authority, where a prosecutor during the middle of trial provided something of value to a juror and it ever made it to the appellate courts. Now, I recognize there's this... I hope
well, it's nice to know we're not bribing jurors on a regular basis in the country.
Well, I have some own anecdotal stories I could tell about how jurors have interacted and how things have been dealt with, but that doesn't solve the issue. But I think that if this had been brought to the attention of the judge during the trial, for sure, Mr. Blair would have been excused. I think any reasonable Trump
well,
court...
Well, let me stop you and let me help you see, because I want you to answer Judge Alley's question for my own benefit as well. Would you agree that the case, that there's no evidence that this case was discussed with this juror at all out in that parking lot?
Well, I think the evidence is that he doesn't remember what was discussed.
I think the evidence is that he asked for a cigarette and maybe made a comment about the weather.
And he doesn't. And I think he said,
beyond that, he doesn't remember.
He doesn't remember what else they talked about.
So the answer to my question sounds like is yes, there's no evidence in this record they ever discussed the case.
That's correct.
Okay. Given that, would you make the same argument if a juror had walked up to the prosecutor, not the prosecutor's secretary, but the prosecutor, on the street corner or in the parking lot and said, do you have the correct time? Is that permissible? Or is that going to require a mistrial?
I would say no.
All right. So the issue is there a difference between asking for a cigarette and asking for the correct time? Is that what this comes down to?
Yes, I think it is.
And a cigarette is something of value. I'm not sure what the value of an individual cigarette is these days, but apparently it's enough in your mind to sway a juror's verdict in a murder case.
Judge, I wouldn't frame the issue the way you framed it.
Well, I mean, Mr. Katz is going to get up and argue in just a second, I suspect. But the point is that the trial court here found that this contact was, in effect, de minimis. Nothing was discussed about the case. It's a small town. I guess in small towns, it's not unreasonable for people to run into each other, you know, in the parking lot. I gather from this record, and I'm not familiar with Lee County as you are, but I gather from this record that there aren't but so many places to park around the courthouse, and the juror is standing out there wanting a cigarette, and I'm not even sure, and he asked for one from somebody who turns out to be the Commonwealth Attorney's Secretary.
Well, and that's done. He was at the corner of the courthouse, and he walks down to where Mr. Qualls and his secretary get out of the car, and he walks to them. I mean, he's just not waiting around for someone to come by and say, can I have a cigarette? He took affirmative action and walked to them.
But isn't it your burden to demonstrate that somehow the verdict was influenced by that giving of a cigarette?
If that's my burden, then I don't win. But I don't agree that's my burden. I think this is such a fundamentally flawed event that this court should not allow that behavior to occur without a remedy. I think there are. I mean, if one cigarette is okay, is a pack of cigarettes not okay? At what level of value is Virginia going to say, we're not going to disturb verdicts if the value is less than $100 or is less than $10? I mean, it's a slippery slope when we get into constitutional issues here that say, this is our cutoff. If it's this amount of money, it's de minimis, as long as the juror says it didn't make any difference to me. There are bright line rules there, and I'm suggesting to this court that the court to adopt that bright line rule. And obviously, you don't have to agree with me, but I'm suggesting that's what the court should do.
Mr. McAfee, a little earlier, and I think largely in jest, Judge Humphreys used the term bribery. Am I going to be correct in assuming that you're not suggesting that the acting prosecutor in this matter was attempting to bribe the juror, and the juror wasn't looking to be bribed with the cigarette, but that it's more the idea of any sort of, whether it's subconscious or otherwise, kind of kinship or bond that can be formed through the giving of an item of value combined with whatever friendly banner it was that wasn't disclosed, the effect that that can have on somebody even if it's not overt.
Can you imagine that this becomes law, that things of value can be given to the juror? So defendant's family can start giving out Walmart cards to jurors. I mean, I'd have no control. I mean, the attorneys don't have any control over that. Certainly the court would be appalled that adversaries of the proceeding are giving gifts to a jury. I mean, it seems that we can't allow even the minimal amount of value to be given to jurors during trial and then not tell anybody about it. And that's why I think a bright line rule is applicable in this kind of case. And I can find no authority where anything like this has ever occurred that made it to the appellate courts.
Mr. McAfee, thank you. I'm still going to give you 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Katz.
Good afternoon. Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. And like my colleague, I think the volume of material before the court would make it impractical to address every assignment of error. I'd like to address some of the issues that have come up today. And if the court has questions for me on topics I've not covered, I would welcome those questions. Briefly, with respect to the issue of the misconduct as it relates to the juror and the cigarette, I would submit that the issue that counsel is asking this court to decide is not the appropriate standard of review given the assignment. This court's determination will not set forth a bright-line rule regarding the value of an item that could be the subject of misconduct. Rather, the issue before this court is whether the trial court abused its discretion in resolving the issue. And I would submit the joint appendix at 3072 sets forth cogently the trial court's rationale for rejecting this argument. And so the issue before this court is to conclude whether any jurist could have found as the trial court did, or whether no jurist could have found as the trial court did, and that decision represents an abuse of discretion. I would submit here it was entirely rational to conclude that the cigarette was of de minimis value and thus it did not amount to misconduct. And Judge Humphreys, as your question indicated, the facts as found by the trial court clearly demonstrated that they did not discuss the case at all. But I think that resolves that issue. This court is not being asked to decide what amount of value to control. It simply did the trial court abuse its discretion in answering that question. As it relates to witness Alford, I think it would be useful to address in some detail the timeline of events as it relates to the objection. It seems like that was muddy before the court today. And I would submit the discussion that happens at 1964 in the joint appendix is a prospective discussion about what may occur in advance of the testimony, that if a statement that came out and impeached the witness were elicited in his testimony, that it could not be used as substantive evidence. And because that took place before the testimony came out, before he was presented with his early remarks and had an opportunity to either ratify them or contradict them, clearly that could not be an objection to that testimony. That is not an objection to the use of impeachment statements. It is a conversation in a vacuum about if this occurs, what is the appropriate result? So I would submit at that point no objection had been made because the testimony had not been elicited. In fact, it's not till 2027 and 2028, after the conclusion of the testimony, after the testimony is taken and the day's proceedings are finished, that there's a conversation about a cautionary instruction. And at that point, I would direct the court to 2171 of the joint appendix, at some point afterwards, where the trial court lays out what it intends to do regarding a cautionary instruction, that it will give that instruction with the other jury instructions at the end of the trial, and counsel acquiesce to the trial court's plan. So I would submit there is no contemporaneous objection as the testimony is elicited that would suggest the cautionary instruction is required at this point. To the extent that the conversation took place after the day's proceeding, if counsel objected to the fact that it hadn't been given sooner, it's too late to make that objection. So I would argue that it's not been preserved for appellate. Beyond that, I would rely on my brief for the merits of that argument. I would like to spend some time talking about the sufficiency of the evidence adduced in trial. Counsel makes much of the scientific evidence that was adduced and claims was ignored by the jury, but I would submit the scientific evidence that he's talking about is the notion that if the defendant had his hand over the pistol in the way he claimed, there would have been an area in which he would not have found blood spatter on the victim's hand. And I would argue that the only evidence things occurred that way at the time of death came from the defendant's own statement. There's no independent evidence that he grabbed the gun in the way he thought he did. And so clearly the jury was not required to accept that. And to the extent that the scientific testimony was premised upon that, if the jury concluded it didn't happen that way, they certainly weren't required to credit.
But even if they did, are they required to accept scientific evidence just because it happens to be scientific evidence?
Certainly not. And moreover, the scientific evidence cut both ways, because there was testimony from scientists that said, if the defendant had his hand on the gun in the way he claimed, you would have expected to find blood spatter on his hand, which was not there. And the court's indulgence, I believe that's 1655. So there is an issue. Clearly, the jury was not required to accept the scientific testimony. Moreover, the scientific testimony hurt the defense as much as it helped the defense. But more significantly, we have an individual who's inconsistent as to the time at which the death occurred. There was evidence from which the jury could conclude it happened much earlier in time based on the Alfreds who were there earlier, that he had attempted to get them away from the house, claiming that the police were on their way. And there was evidence that was adduced at trial that suggested the police were not, in fact, on their way. He was adamant about the way his injury occurred, claiming that the hammer had cut him to the bone, a very specific recollection about how the event he claimed occurred. And yet, on brief, they suggest that perhaps he was mistaken in light of the expert testimony that said, well, he might have been cut in a different way, not the way he imagined. So the jury could see that and conclude that he had been dishonest with the police in his recollection of how it happened. From that, they could infer consciousness of his guilt. Moreover, the certificate of analysis related to the weapon at 109 and 110 affirmatively found the absence of any tissue or blood in the hammer area of the pistol, directly contradicting his assertion of how he were injured. And he indicated at the emergency room that he'd been cut by a lawn. So clearly the jury heard all of this evidence and could have concluded that he was lying as to the circumstances surrounding the injury. Moreover, there was the complaint about the pain suffered in his right hand when he went to the emergency room. That was at 1811 of the joint. I'm sorry, that was the wrong one. And I apologize, I don't have an appendix site for the emergency room testimony regarding the pain to his right hand, the worst pain he'd ever felt. But the argument was made at trial that that was consistent with the report of a pistol, the shock associated with firing a pistol. So there was clearly ample evidence that the jury could have concluded that the defendant was misleading police as to the events and circumstances, that he evidenced the consciousness of his own guilt, and that it could not have happened the way he claimed, given the absence of his DNA in the hammer area. And it very likely could have been that he fired the weapon in recognition of the pain that he claimed to have suffered in his hand. With that, I'm happy to address any questions.
Well, I have a question about the prosecutor's demonstration. In the abstract, I think we could agree prosecutors have no business being witnesses. Is that what happened here? And if so, if it was error, is it, is a harmless error argument to be made, or how do you want to address that?
Well, I would assert that the issue before the court is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in resolving the objection the way it did?
Well, your opponent asserts that no cautionary instruction was ever actually given. I couldn't read the record.
Well, I think the record is clear that one was. Of course, it wasn't. This is at 2586. The court clearly says the jury will disregard. And I would also note that the objection raised on appeal is that this amounts to a constitutional violation. That argument was conspicuously absent before the trial. The trial court was never alerted that this was of a constitutional dimension. In fact, the objection is simply that he's injecting himself personally into the case and prohibit him from demonstrating the weapon on himself, never alerting the trial court that a constitutional claim was being raised. So I would submit the trial court clearly told the jury to disregard the argument that it had made, and that the jurisprudence would suggest that that's certainly sufficient to resolve whatever claim might be made about the impropriety of the argument that was addressed by the special assistant commonwealth's attorney. I would not inject my own opinion as to the proper way to try a case, but I would submit that to the extent that he was incorrect in doing so, the trial court's prompt direction to the jury to resolve whatever error might have occurred. And clearly, to the extent he claims now that this was of a constitutional dimension, the trial court never had an opportunity to hear that argument and to address that argument. So I would submit that, that aspect of it would be waiting for me.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that,
I will rely on my brief. Thank you.
As promised, Mr. McPhee, a strict 2 minutes.
I would ask the court to look at the entire dialogue, you know, as reflect on the transcript about what was this objection about. Mr. Qualls clearly objected that he had become a witness. He was testifying, and there was back and forth. And the only thing the court says in response to Mr. Qualls' comment is, I apologize for making a comment, and the court says, I'll ask the jury to disregard. And that's the extent of this alleged cautionary instruction.
I see something. It says, with the court, there's some discussion about whether or not the jury is to be excused while this goes on, and you indicate that you don't wish for the jury to be excused, and the judge indicates they're ready to make a ruling. And I see by the court, all right, ladies and gentlemen, you may be reseated. I'm not going to grant a mistrial. The motion is overruled. Mr. Qualls, sir, I would ask you to please continue the questions of the witness. And then Mr. Qualls states, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I made a statement, and I apologize. And is that the end of...
And then,
the
of course,
dialogue
the
on that.
I don't know what she
well, the jury, was the jury in the box at the time the court says I'm going to instruct the jury to disregard it?
Well,
he didn't.
Or something.
He,
okay.
And all I hear by the court is the word disregard that's kind of in the midst of, and the jury will, and then there's an interruption by you, and judge, will you, and it just says, and the jury will, and then another statement that says disregard.
And ask a question or something. And I said, then I believe the record should say, are you going to allow him to continue to demonstrate in the manner that he's... Are you going to permit him to continue to do this? And the court says, well...
If there's an objection to a future question, then it may be made at the appropriate time.
So, that's the section of the appendix that I would ask the court to.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure... 15 seconds. My brief on jury instructions, I believe it's clearly error in not allowing the instruction 3B... 5 seconds. I appreciate the questions from the court. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel before we begin the next case.
Mr. Katz, how are you?
I'm well, sir. Nice to see you, Judge.
Mr. McAfee?
Yes, sir. Good to see you.
Yes.
Nice to see you, Judge.